I saw Andy Sore in the library. There's
supposedly a diamond mine.
Andy Sore was here. Andy, you should come on out there. And he just laughed at me. To hear. That's all I'm saying. It's 5 minutes ago.
Now 7 o'clock, regular meeting of the Blue Mountain County Planning Commission for July 23rd, 2014, is now in session. First order of business, the pledge of allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Next item on our agenda will be the director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had several board actions last week. The board deferred both the SUP and the master plan amendment for Poplar Ridge Hotel Street Capital until the August 6, 2014 meeting. And the board also approved Mr. Stoneman for the SUP for the kennel. And the SUP request from Ms. Joyce Parr for the school. But again, Poplar Ridge will be heard at the August 6th Board of Supervisors meeting at 7 o'clock.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Is there a likelihood that it's going to get sent back to us?
You never know. I really don't expect that, but stranger things have happened.
You don't say.
In fact, similar things have happened.
Spoken like an attorney right there. Edged all his bets.
Normally at this time we have a public comment, but seeing no public here, we'll move on to approval of minutes for our June 25th, 2014 meeting.
Yes, you do.
Mr. Gaines seconds. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. There are no public hearings tonight, but we do have a presentation from Mr. Lindsay about cash properties.
Just a little background information. Mr. Bibb, Commissioners, the Board of Supervisors, through Mr. Nichols, has requested that we look into cash proffers again. And Jay's just spurring the discussion with a presentation. We'll take any questions or comments you have back to Mr. Nichols and from there.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
It's my intention to be brief, but it's a fairly complicated subject, so I'm going to rush through as quickly as I can, but please stop me at any point with questions. First of all, what is a cash proffer? It's a one-time voluntary monetary commitment by a property owner. It's made at the time of rezoning. It's used for capital facilities and to create additional capacity within the community. It's the capacity to support a larger population in whichever facility we're discussing. It offsets the impact of the rezoning on capital facilities. Again, that goes back to the idea of capacity. It offsets the new strain in demand on facilities. And it represents new growth's fair share of capital facility needs and costs rather than for all of the current citizens to bear the full cost. The idea is that the people coming in that are creating the new demand ought to contribute to that as well. It is not a way to raise revenue. It's not a mechanism for that. It's a way to meet growth-related infrastructure needs. It provides infrastructure as growth occurs, and again, it reflects a proportionate share of capital costs for improvements. The payers must receive a benefit. Obviously, by moving into the county, your children can then go to the schools that you're proffering. So the payer is receiving a benefit in that example. You wouldn't expect a proffer that in no way benefited the payer. Enabling legislation comes from Virginia State Code. High-growth localities in Virginia, including Fluvanna, may accept cash payments as a reasonable condition of a rezoning or amendment to a zoning map. No proffer can be accepted unless the county has adopted a capital improvements program. Payment of cash proffers shall not be made until the facilities for which the proffer is offered are included in the CIP. Proffered conditions shall provide for the disposition of cash payment in the event that the cash payment is not used for the purpose for which it's proffered. So if it was originally proffered for one thing and then that's no longer necessary, there needs to have been a provision for a different disposition of the cash payment. There can be no proffers for by right development, and approval or disapproval of conditional rezoning may not be based solely on the proffers. No contribution for schools, parks, or libraries is expected for commercial and industrial applications because their growth is thought to cover more of their costs, meaning that they generate sufficient revenue that they're already paying their fair share. The zoning itself must give rise to the need for the conditions. In other words, a growing population would give rise to the need for more capacity. There's a reasonable relation there. Conditions must have a reasonable relation to the zoning. All conditions that are made in the rezoning must be in conformity with the comprehensive plan. And the Board of Supervisors determines whether the amount proffered is related both in nature and extent to the projected impact of the development. The county will continue to consider any circumstances about a proposed development that mitigate the development's projected impact or create a demonstrable reduction in capital facility needs. In other words, in the interest of this being fair, if it were to come to light later that a proffer was not needed or that the demand didn't justify the proffer, then that could be changed and mitigated. And that can be a role played by either the county, the applicant, or any other person that becomes aware of those mitigating circumstances. Cash proffers are very often spent on schools, specifically school construction, the acquisition of land for schools, mobile units, buses, and administrative facilities, also known as support facilities. It's also used for parks, libraries, fire and rescue, and roads. These are all things that have capacity based on population, so an increase in population is related to their functioning. In 2010, 72% of proffer spending in Virginia went to either schools, roads, or public safety, fairly closely split between schools and transportation improvements. Most of the remainder went to parks, open space, and affordable housing. And that's just a look at across the state how that spending looks. Adopting a cash proffer is recommended in the following sections of the 2009 Fluvanna Comprehensive Plan. It's recommended in land use, in infrastructure, transportation, housing, and financial sustainability. So a total of five of the chapters of the Comprehensive Plan. Now we're going to look at the methodology, which depending is either your favorite or least favorite part. This is pulled from an example. This is Isle of Wight's, and they used the firm Titchler Bees, who have done quite a few localities around the state, and even when they aren't the ones to do it, their method is very often used, their methodology. So I'm going to go through that as quickly as I can. So we begin by figuring out what our demand generators are. That's the average number of people and of students per housing unit. then we figure out our service levels, and that's different for each facility. So you would have a certain amount of acres of parkland per 1,000 people, or a certain amount of library books per person, or a certain amount of square feet of space per elementary school child. And so those become the service levels that are used in the calculation. Using the demand generators and the service levels, the gross cost of public facilities is determined. And that's gross because what happens next is that credits are applied to that cost. And the reasoning for that is that public facilities construction is funded by general obligation bonds, which are obviously not paid off in 1 year. So, for example, if you were to move here in 2000, you would still be paying for the new facilities or the upgrades to the facilities over the course of that loan. And so that's taken into account and taken out of what the proffers originally would be. And that gives you your net cost, which is gross cost minus any credits. And that should yield the maximum acceptable proffer. What actually goes into this, you can see here, it actually starts here at the bottom. So school construction cost per student is found out through the demand generators and the service levels, plus land cost per student, plus the cost of mobile units per student, and the cost of buses per student, and administrative support facilities per student. And then, of course, as I mentioned, that is all weighed against the credit, and that gives you the net cost. What's important to note there is, and I'll get back to this in 1 second, that's only one of five of the calculations, the methodologies used to come up with the total proffer. So in addition to the school one that I'm going over in depth, they also did one for parks and recreation using a similar formula, one for the sheriff, one for fire and rescue, and one for the library. And then all of those are combined to give the final total maximum acceptable cash proffer. So delving into the methodology just a little more so that you can see where it comes from, these would be up at the top, the students per housing unit, based on what type of house it is, and also what type of housing unit, based on the size of the house and the type of housing unit. And you come up with these numbers. And then you do the same for middle schools. So you have elementary, middle, and high school, and each one has a different one of these demand generators. And then that gives you your total students per housing unit. Then we determine the cost per unit, and that's based on those levels of service as we discussed. So that would be site acreage and building square feet. And then you put that into terms of per children. So site acreage per student, acres per student, and square footage of building per student, as well as mobile units per student. Should I wait?
That's Mr. O'Brien.
Okay. So then that continues with your school construction costs, land acquisition costs, buses, school support facilities, and again, using the the credits to avoid double payment, you're then able to calculate the final numbers. And so what would happen is you have your total gross capital cost per student, which is much higher than what your proffer is going to be. Then you have your principal payment, which is the credit. Then you end up with this number here, which is still larger than what your proffer is going to be because you multiply the capital cost per student by the number of students per household, which is less than one. So this number is going to reduce. So what you end up with are three numbers in this case, a single family cash proffer, a multifamily, and a manufactured home. And you can see the numbers they came up with were 9,000, 7, and then the other two were 7,000 each. Is everybody kind of with me so far on the methodology? Okay. As I mentioned, there's a number of other ones. Now I'll look at what some other proffers in the area look like. Albemarle charges, or excuse me, does not charge. Albemarle accepts up to $20,460 per single family detached, $13,000, almost $14,000 for townhomes, and almost $15,000 for the multifamily. Louisa accepts $4,000. Goochland accepts $14,000, and they have done so for quite some time. It's been a few years since they've changed theirs. Cumberland accepts $5,000. Green accepts $5,700. And our most recent two proposed numbers based on this methodology were $5,200 in 2013 and $6,500 in 2011. Recent proffers that have been accepted by the county include $50,000 to VDOT for a signal at 53 and Turkey Sag. That was for the development of Nahor. Rivanna Village was $2,000 per townhome unit for the development of Pleasant Grove. Sycamore Square was $3,000 per attached unit, totaling $198,000. Their single family was $1,000 per detached unit. Stonehenge, you can see there were three different ones, $5,000 for residential, $1,000 additional per unit for low-income housing repairs, and a $50,000 traffic signal. And then Village Oaks was $5,000 to VDOT for traffic improvements near the lake. This is just a look at, again, the previous calculation that was come up with using the methodology of the levels of service, the gross cost weighed against the credits. This obviously is the number here for just the schools, and then adding in for fire stations, libraries, and parks, that gives you that total acceptable proffer. There obviously are sometimes questions as to why have one of these, why have proffers. So rather than argue for them, I would prefer to give a couple of questions regarding what would happen if we continued to not have them. From where would funds made necessary by new development come? And of course, the answer is that it would come from the existing tax base. If proffers are no longer accepted, will established citizens who have already absorbed their cost of development through previous proffers be forced to pay twice? Meaning that if you were in one of those developments that we've discussed that paid a proffer, now you live here and you've paid for facilities, but the people that are moving in next are not, is that a form of making you pay twice? What alternatives are there for highlighting and addressing the cost of development? Again, this isn't a revenue-raising adventure. This is to pay for infrastructure, but it's also to highlight and address that there are costs to development. Frankly, the majority of conversations that you have about the costs to the community of development come from discussions of proffers and things like that. So without the presence of proffers, where would that conversation come from? And then finally, does no-cost rezoning support the purposes of managing growth that have been made clear in the comprehensive plan? And again, those are questions to be thought about, not necessarily answers. As far as our next steps, the commission may elect to pursue the development and implementation of a cash proffer policy, not pursue the development and implementation of a cash proffer policy, or direct planning staff to conduct more research on the issue. And then a big question, should Fluvanna hire a consultant? And there are a couple of reasons that could be a good idea. One is their experience. They do this. That's all they do. Another is that they have resources such as access to better demographic data. I could go back to the Isle of Wight methodology that I showed you and show where their consultant was able to tailor census data to specifically fit their demographics. And that's something that takes skill and resources. They also have the time. That's all that they do. They don't have other projects in front of them. And then finally, and I believe this to be the most important one, which is credibility. When you're talking about money and the potential of people spending money, it's important for them to have confidence in it. And while staff is confident in staff, it seems that there would be an increased air of legitimacy to a determined proffer amount were it done by recognized authority. And again, I'm not advocating either way. I'm just making clear the questions related to that. One thing worth noting is that in the Isle of Wight example, the cost of the proffers were absorbed, the cost of the consultant was absorbed into the proffers as it's part of the process. So it was, I believe, something like $8,000, and that was spread over the however many students they had in the development.
Sorry, was that 8,000 or 80,000?
Eight. Yes.
So it was only, I was...
Yeah, it's like eight, nine, I think. I can get back there quick enough. Consultant study cost per student was $24.21. And it came out to 8,000, or 8,900. Oh, total consultant fee, $88.33 was what that came out to. And that gets me to the end of the presentation. I appreciate everybody sitting through that because I know it was a little dry. I'm happy to answer whatever questions I can.
Well, we've done this almost every year that I've been on the Planning Commission. And we've passed it on to the Board of Supervisors, and they've decided to shelve it every time.
Jay, this was a very good presentation. Can you email it to us?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I noticed that on your first slide, it said that because Savannah was a high-growth county.
By their standards that they have, and again, you know, that was from the 20 to the 2010 census. So I believe they just don't have the data to say yet that we're not.
Yeah, but we know what we are.
Right.
We know what our growth rate is.
Sure.
And it's not even 1%.
Right.
So, you know, do you want to? That's something that we need to take into consideration.
That sure.
And I understand when we were the second fastest growing county, that made more sense, but I'm not so sure. I think, you know, how many building permits have we had so far? We didn't get any.
Well, I think this was based on something that the legislature passed some years ago.
The significance of it is that there are different statutes that relate to certain counties, and one of them is this category of fast growing counties, which I think it's 10% a year or something.
10%.
And there's it's slightly different and, let's say, more liberal enabling legislation for the fast-growing counties. So you're absolutely right, Mr. Zier, that Savannah is not what I would call fast-growing at this point, but it still falls under that statute.
It's still to our advantage, right?
It makes... Next, I guess you could say that. It kind of depends on. That's kind of a normative question, but it gives us more liberal authority. Let's put it that way.
And I believe, having looked at this when I lived in another county, that statute also included or a neighboring county met that standard.
I don't remember exactly what it does. A lot of them do that,
yeah.
And a lot of these statutes do that, and they talk about being adjacent to cities and having cities right. contained within and things like that. So
I think we would continue to fall under that, even if the legislation, once we met it, we're good. I think that's how it works too. Albemarle, Charlottesville would allow us to continue to fall under this, if I'm correct.
Well, probably would, but it's really up to the General Assembly. They change that enabling legislation, it could change the effect.
Right.
The way that law developed over time was really interesting. I tried to get a better understanding of it, and it was a series of compromises over bitter disputes, and so you, rather than name names in the at the state level, they would say, you know, all counties over 100,000 persons south of 64 but west of 95 and east of Afton or something like that, and so it was very patchwork, and then it becomes more complicated because we're the only Commonwealth, we're the only state that does this. So if you try and look at what other people are doing, your options are pretty limited as far as...
There's a reason for that. There's all these population limits and geographic locations and stuff, and that is that the law used to prohibit, well, it does prohibit what's called special legislation, and special legislation was at one point, and I think this has changed now, but at one point it was deemed to include naming a locality. So you couldn't say the city of Petersburg has the right to do so-and-so. You had to say Petersburg is, you know, 112,000 people, so any city that has a population of more than 110 but less than 114 has the right to do so-and-so. Gee, Petersburg is the only one that qualifies. So they've liberalized that to some extent. Let me make one comment about this, and that is, this is a system that I'd say is kind of grown like Topsy. You know, it there's really no rhyme or reason to it. And the key word here is profit. Because as you know, there are profit, you can have profits for a lot of things in zoning. And 50 years ago, there was a case that specifically prohibited conditioning a rezoning. It didn't matter whether the applicant asked for it or anything else, you couldn't condition rezoning. There was a Supreme Court case on that point. Then somebody came up with the idea of, well, what happens if the landowner is willing to condition a rezoning? And the first proffer statutes came from that, with that concept. And you see this, you're all familiar with this, because it'll be somebody wants to apply for, let's say, rezoning from R1 to B1. But he only wants two or three uses. And he comes in and says, the following list of uses are things that could be a problem on this property, so we'll proffer that we won't use those. Those won't apply. Or we'll proffer that we'll put in a stoplight, or we'll proffer that we'll put in an extra lane along the whole frontage of our property, something that the county couldn't require. That still exists. It's alive and well. There are restrictions on how to do that. But then a question came up with, why can't we just offer money? And of course, the problem you get with that is, that sounds like something you do in New Jersey. You know, I'll give you $100,000 if you rezone my property.
Brooklyn.
Well, that's close to New Jersey.
Forget about it.
Exactly. And so that was pretty distasteful, and so that was prohibited. And then the idea came up: well, why do we want to prohibit it? Just allow the county, allow the localities a source of revenue to dispel the expenses incumbent on attendant on growth, and that's where the cash proffers come from. Now, there was a seminal case on this. You've probably heard me say this before, but there was a seminal case on this that came from, I think it was Cumberland County, may have been Powhatan, and this is probably 15 years ago, and the question was, the statute said it's got to be voluntary proffer. And the county basically said, well, we're not going to make you proffer this money. We have every indication that you ain't going to get this rezoning unless you do. But we're not making you do it. And somebody whose advocacy I admire got the Supreme Court to accept the fact that that was voluntary. And that's where we go now, where we are now. Mr. Lindsay made what I think he thinks was a slip of the tongue, but was actually more like a Freudian slip, when he said Albemarle charges the following dollars for rezonings. It's not an option in Albemarle. They don't even make a pretense of it. If you apply for rezoning, here's what you got to pay for. And so far, nobody's challenged. I think that I'm not telling you not to do this. It does have some attractions. I would, however, caution you that there are some drawbacks to this whole process. One of which is, I think sooner or later, the Supreme Court's going to get around either to striking it down, or the General Assembly's going to liberalize it. One of the two. So don't put all your eggs in one basket. There's a different approach to this which is, and I can't remember the term for it, it's not development fees, but it's
impact fees.
Impact fees. And there are impact fees for, there's a couple of statutes on it, and you can do it for certain things, mainly for roads. The difference is, this is quite simply an assessment. If you're in a locality that can charge impact fees, the county sets the locality sets the impact fee. If you're a developer and you fall within the category of it, you pay it. And it's really like a development tax. It's a much more rational system. You don't have to go through this pretense of it being, oh, gee, wasn't this generous of this developer to give me this money? Because we all know it's not optional. And it's much more predictable. So the developers know they're going to have to pay it, and the county, the locality knows that it can rely on it coming in. My crystal ball guess is that sooner or later, at some point after the economy comes into a real recovery, the General Assembly is going to get around to broadening the scope of impact fees. When it does, I think they'll come to supplant or largely supplant impact profits, cash profits. But just as background, let me just leave you with the injunction. If you talk about a proffer, that does not necessarily mean cash. It might, but it might mean any number of other things. So this is only a subset of the concept of zoning proffers. And it is, as he said, only applicable in the case of a rezoning. So if the developer comes in and says, I want to put in a 5,000 lot subdivision by right, proffers don't enter into it. There's a little background for you.
And if the Supreme Court decides to visit them, they come back and they say, you know, we don't think this is legal, then proffers stop at that point in time. There's no retroactive penalty, if you would, at that point. That would be almost impossible to impose, I think.
Well, I think that's likely. I think the Supreme Court, if they did that, would make it prospective only in application. But my caution remains, though, because it's like getting used to getting used to having a drink every evening, and all of a sudden you get cut off. You don't want to get yourself too extended in that way.
Being in a dry county can be tough too.
My wife went to college in one. I know about that.
I think 2009, 2010, the impact fee came to the legislature. They put it off for a study because some of the counties didn't think the amount that they were proposing was enough. And of course, it was the time the recession was still going on.
All these things are controversial because the developers have a visceral reaction to anything that involves a mandatory payment. And the developers have good lobbies. And in some sense, the developer really shouldn't care because it's like any other business tax. The business doesn't pay the tax. It's passed through to the customer. And, of course, that's the other thing you need to worry about is you can see where these numbers are, like with Albemarle, for example. If you really want to encourage low and moderate income housing, this is not a good way to do it because the cost, the assessment or whatever you want to call it, is going to get passed on to the buyer. So, you know, if there's a $10,000 assessment per unit, I won't tell you the price is going up $10,000. It might go up 11, or it might go up 9, but it's certainly not going to stay the same. So there are pros and cons of all of this stuff. And I'm not telling you not to do it. The methodologies, you know, the details are sophisticated, but the concept's not. And we did do that study in 2009 or whatever it was. And it wasn't perfect, but it made some sense. So if you wanted to do it, I think it could be implemented pretty quickly.
With regard to the legitimacy that you mentioned as far as, you know, having consultants legitimize the numbers, if you would. Can you elaborate a little bit on
that? Sure. I was asked to do this or something pretty similar to this last year, and just from experience, your whatever number I were to say, the developers would say that number is high, and for example, members of the taxpaying public would say that number is far too low, and you're leaving the citizens holding the bag, and anyway, you're just a planner. What do you know about finances? So that was a conversation that happened a few times last year, certainly not anything unpleasant, and you know, it's illustrative for everybody. It was just a question of, well, like I said, it's a question of legitimacy, where, you know, where it's not county staff that did this and determined the numbers. It's seen as more of like this outside neutral party that's experienced in it. So I think legitimacy, I guess credibility would be more the word I meant than legitimacy, but yeah, it's just, I don't know if there would be any true repercussions from one versus the other, or if it would just be a perception thing, but I certainly think there would at least be some element of that.
There's two old sayings about this. One is the definition of an expert, and an expert is traditionally defined as a guy that carries a briefcase and lives 50 miles from here. The other one is a prophet is never honored in his own country. And at the end of the day, that's really what we're talking about.
In some pastures, their finance department actually didn't figure it out.
The thing about it is, if you use a consultant, he's going to have to use those numbers. So, again, I think consultants can be pretty handy. I'm not really sure it's necessary for something like this, because we've got competent staff, and we've already done it once, at least once. So I think they're competent to come up with defensible numbers.
We've hired a consultant in the past, is what you're saying?
No,
staff.
We didn't. We did it in-house, and I think it was competently done. It would be defensible.
I was not aware of that, but staff could absolutely do this. It was, I guess, the main reason I mentioned legitimacy was as opposed to competency. It's not an issue of staff not being capable of it. It simply, which number would be better received was my point on that.
And if we were to look at impact fees as opposed to proffers, what's the timeline?
You really don't have, I don't think there is a timeline on that, because you really don't have adequate enabling legislation for Fluvanna County to do that. We could I think we could do some of it.
Yes.
But it's pretty limited for roads. So it's, that's a matter of going down and leaning on the legislature. And I think they got enough eggs in their basket right now.
And to your point of, you know, yes, it gets passed on to the consumer, but likewise, it's a double-edged sword in the sense of the county's only sources of revenues are really real estate tax. Then, you know, that also gets passed on to the consumer in a form as well, too.
It does.
When you're competitive or not competitive, right? It creates a perception.
You're absolutely right. One of the problems that a lot of people have been talking about for a long time is that the current tax legislation for localities is really quite limited, and it's really antiquated. And you know, if you got a county that has nothing but productive farms, real estate tax makes a lot of sense, because if you've got a lot of land and valuable farmland, you're going to produce more. But as the further you get away from that, the more regressive and really inappropriate real estate tax becomes, because you're not making anything on your house.
Right.
If you got a factory, you're making money on the land of that factory and the buildings, but you're not on your house. And when your primary real estate taxable real estate is residential, it's pretty regressive.
And you don't hear a lot of people screaming saying, you know, your county's proffers are too high, I'm not going to move there. That's not something that you hear the taxpayers saying, right?
Well, one of the
versus,
things
versus, you know, people saying, oh, well, your tax rate's too high. I'm not going to move to that.
If you look back at that chart, you notice that Albemarle was way, way higher than anybody else. And one of the reasons is Albemarle has, to a large extent, a captive audience because the university's there. You have a very large, quite wealthy, and wealth-distributing economic engine in Albemarle County that you don't have in other counties. So people will do that. And that what you said, and that is, if it's a question of going to Bedford County instead of Franklin County, it may very well make a difference if, oh, I got to buy this new house in Franklin County, and it's $8,000 cheaper than the one in Bedford because of the assessments. That might make a difference there.
Right. But since all the surrounding counties essentially already have a proper policy, it doesn't make us any less or more.
No, it wouldn't. I don't think it would make any difference. Right.
Mr. Brown, I'm sorry.
The point is the point I was making was that the developer is, you know, he's like the corporate income tax on General Motors. You know, the General Motors doesn't pay that tax. The people that buy Chevys pay that tax.
I was just going to kind of build on what he's saying there. The home buyer would, well, depending on the home buyer, would possibly not even be aware that a proffer is a thing. They would just know that this house is $8,000 more than that house.
Right. Well, the thing they know is that Albemarle County housing is more expensive than Green or Fluvanna. And they accept that because, you know, whatever reason, it's more prestigious, they like the schools better, whatever it is, shorter drive, whatever.
Yeah, I do know recently Albemarle talked about going away from their proffers. But just see an article that they decided that wasn't a good idea. So they're going to keep proffers. So I saw that like a week ago. To keep properties. My suggestion is to address the limited staff, what is the finance department and so forth, figure out using the CIP and all the parameters what our profit would be at this time. I know we've seen it 5,000, 6,000, and all that changes a lot to do with your CIP. I think we'll send it back to the Board of Supervisors, because we have constantly, almost every year that I've been on the Planning Commission, asked to do the same exact thing. And we've sent it to the Board of Supervisors.
And then they shelve it.
Well, a lot of times you get to close the election.
Exactly.
And get shelved.
Exactly.
And, I mean, that's just plain fact.
Yeah.
I think it also would be helpful to cost some of the lots around the county in the different sections, because I think you'd be surprised how little they're bringing now, and that's I think also a consideration. So if you have a lot out in I don't know, over by where Gordon Faulkner, there's some lots over there that. They're pretty cheap. They're not selling.
This wouldn't apply to lots. It would apply to when a house is constructed.
Well,
so
actually, it only applies when it's a
zone. Exactly.
Right.
Only will apply when it's changed the zoning. Right.
You're not going to
have. That's the only way.
Right. The problem, one of the problems with this is when the growth rate goes down, the supply of proffers goes down with it.
Sure.
For exactly that reason. Now, of course, that's not that's not unpredictable or unnatural, because the money for the proffers is designed to accommodate the growth.
Right, and you know, I mean, I think we should at least pursue it and find out what it is. I mean, we didn't do it. We didn't have this in place when there was significant growth. And you could, I mean, that could be good, and that we didn't get, you know, addicted to this. I understand your point there, but at the same time, having in place may have helped moderate that some, smooth that out a little bit, may or may not have. And if it didn't, then the money would have been available for one thing. As long as the Board of Supervisors, who are the real money people,
Tony, understand that this is a little bit like crack cocaine. You don't want to get addicted to it.
True, but the nice thing about that you have to some degree of, you know, you have another lever that you can use, and because it's tied to the CIP, the more predictable funding that there is for the CIP, because our CIP is unfunded, if you would, the more likely that projects don't get deferred. You know, and then of course, if we fall into a retractive period, well, then yes, the more likely the project gets deferred.
Right.
But there is some flexibility in the use of that money over a couple of years. So, you know, we were planning on building, you know, the school in 2015, but we're going to put it out to 2017 because we have a little bit of a lull here. Yeah, as an example, I'm not saying that that's 100% there, but the predictability of the funds for that can be very useful. It can be a very useful tool across the board and can be useful for planning purposes by all departments. So.
Yeah, I think it's. And if it gets taken away by the legislature or they change it to MBAC fees, then we will have to adapt when time comes.
That's right. I mean, if they took it away, if they took it away and didn't have impact fees, you know, well, most of the county's tax rates in the area would skyrocket. Yeah. There is no other solution, right, you know, other than cut services. So.
This was just a presentation. I'm not. Do you know what?
We can work with Mr. Dahl at the finance department and come back with some more information at a future meeting, and we can discuss it further. And a number.
Is it
what you all want to do?
Is it appropriate to bring that to them, and then they would make the motion to
think,
go?
I would think so.
So staff will be happy to work this into the work week, and as soon as we get closer to a number, we'll let you know, and we can try and get it onto a commission meeting, or discuss at a work session based on your preference.
If we could get it to say, and I don't know how long something sure. like this would take, so maybe if we had it at our next regular meeting, then we could make some type of motion about whether to send it on to the board sort of level. Or we don't think it's a good idea.
Sure.
That's because we have to make a motion to send it to the Board of Supervisors. Boy, I think I may be wrong about that, but because they asked us to do it, right?
Well, you can initiate the change, but I think under these circumstances, it would be better to work, if you will, cooperatively with the board and just report to them what your thoughts are and let them react to that.
I would suspect the board would be receptive to it being brought forth to them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Starting to get a yes to have it back.
Now, none of the other items until we get out of unfinished business we have on the agenda tonight, and that unfinished business is the comprehensive plan. We were sent 5 chapters with some of the changes that were made. We're actually also supposed to be going into the economic development chapter. Did you say Mr. Popovich is going to come?
It'll be at our work session in August.
At a work session, so probably we'll talk about the economic development at that time, too.
Is he going to be at the next work session?
Yes, the one in August.
One in August.
Back, we did just recently did infrastructure, and we had some information given to us about water and so forth like that. And I had something troubling told me, and I don't think it's exactly right, but I was told by somebody that should be in the know that the DOD was a dead deal now. Although it's part of what this Stephen gave to us.
I'm sorry, the DOC?
DOC.
Oh, no, I was not aware of that.
Well, I don't think it's exactly right, but I think it's still okay. But We don't want to just write a comprehensive document.
Right.
Well, there is, we do have a contract with them, and it is terminable, but my suggestion would be let the staff follow up on it and see if what you were told is correct. And obviously you want to react to it. If it is correct, then you want to take account of it. But until you determine that it's off, I would have the presumption that it's on.
Well, like last time we did the infrastructure thing, and we were talking about water and so forth, and we got a route for basically how the water was going to run, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this eastern pipeline came up. Then we had to go back and rewrite the comprehensive plan all after it was already passed. So, we need to have a plan. If we're going to write a comprehensive plan, we need to, everybody needs to be on the same page.
The discussions that I've had with regard to water have been primarily that regardless as to which entity is doing processing or not doing processing, that you would expect the development of pipes up and down 250 and 15, right? You know, how far up and down, you know, that's a question mark, but you would expect that. The county right now is undergoing some groundwater studies in that area, which we should have that information back soon, I hope. And that would lead to whether we use wells temporarily in the Zions Crossroads area and whether we have more dependency on the DOC or not, and so there's different moving pieces, and I'm not sure that all those pieces would be lined out before the comprehensive plan comes up. But I understand what you're saying.
Well, we hear rumors, but we don't get real information. And when we're writing this, we need to be on the same page as board supervisors and so forth like that, because like I said, I'd rather be a competent plan than a competent document.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, and I would just say that my sense of where water is, and this is just my sense, not speaking for the board, is just that it's still kind of a set of moving pieces as different aspects are being negotiated, if you like.
I think we really do need to, each of us, maybe talk to our supervisor and find out what he thinks or she thinks of the comprehensive plan, if they feel that it is, we're on the same page. Because I know we're trying to get business, and it's not working out so well. So when you read the comprehensive plan, you get the idea that we really don't want business. It's more about green infrastructure and,
preservation,
historic. And so we need to have a better idea which direction the board wants to take this. And I don't know if we could have a meeting with them or whether it would be productive just to talk with our individual representatives. I don't know what you think about that. Just when the first event, of course, if we're starting out with natural environment, and that would be about that, but it continues through the whole book. On page 5, it says Blavatnik contains 180,000 acres. And it talks about how much is in forest and ag, and if you do percentage on that, it's over 11%. And in conservation easements, it's 8%. Then they're talking on page 14, goal 3 is to raise the minimum water per household from 1 gallon a minute to something higher. But
that's in natural environment?
Page 14.
I think that was to increase the standard, go above the state standard of 1 gallon per minute as a requirement for a residential development. I guess that's a minimum well requirement, which that sort of surprised me in general, because that seems like a very low yield, but so I guess the Virginia Department of Health minimum, so it would be a standard above that, which is being
attacked. It's 1,440 gallons in a 24-hour period, and right. Cost doesn't use near that much, but even when we were talking about Poplar Ridge, if you multiply the number of units and put in a little extra for the business, you'd have to have over 500,000 gallons a day coming out of the ground. That's a lot of water. Now, they are saying they would only use 134,000, I think. Is that right?
That sounds very close to what they said, yeah.
So, but still, the health department saying, no, you know, that's the minimum standard, 500,000 gallons a day. So,
but if you go into further into that, the same pages that talks about the Virginia Water Resources Center says a well yield of at least 6 gallons per minute is usually needed for home use. So 10 gallons per minute is more desirable.
I think that's wrong.
I believe Mr. Stevens, when we spoke to him, said that that sounded excessive to him as well. I can double check that, but I think Mr. Stevens said that that was a high number.
Well, I do think that, I mean, it's a bigger question, really, in terms of, you know, in terms of the county saying what are the standards that they're going to use for, and what is the criteria that they're going to use in providing clarity for developers so that, you know, early on in the process, decisions and understandings are there in terms of, I'm going to have to accomplish this hurdle, or I'm going to have to do this. And, you know, to me, that, in my little experience in the planning side, that seems like it's been a moving target, if you would, to some degree. So, you know, if, for example, we will continue to face stringent requirements from the DEQ with regard to sewers, you know, what is the county's policies and what are the county's ordinances with regard to alternative sewage systems, whether drip fields, whether centralized, whether those. There doesn't seem to be an awful lot of information that's tangible that somebody can have, and so then we're left with, you know, citizens and planning members and board members all saying, well, I think the standard should be this, and is it above what the DEQ standard is, and where am I responsible or not responsible? And so it makes it, I think, hard to establish the faith in that, and is this newfangled technology, or is it 40-year-old technology? You know, that you hear all those arguments, but at the end of the day, it's a planning tool, right? If we are limited by our infrastructure with regard to sewer, and we are looking to have planned development within CPA zones, whatever that definition is, you know, we want it here at Zion's Crossroads or not. I mean, let's assume that the only CPA we have is Zion's Crossroads. We might still not have viable sewer choices available for 4 to 5 years, maybe 7 or 8 years. And so what is the county's policies on drip fields, as an example, right? And those are the types of things that I think would be useful for us to incorporate in this process. And I'm not really sure, again, my ignorance here, I see the highlighted yellow items. I guess that's recommendations and changes coming back from you guys, coming to us for discussion.
In the document?
In the document.
Yeah, those are things that I've highlighted because I changed them, and I didn't want to slip them in.
Right.
There are also sometimes, if it's highlighted, I guess this is complicated now that I'm saying it out loud. Sometimes if it's highlighted, it's because I had a question for somebody that I wished to follow up on. But generally, yeah, those are things that I added and wanted to get feedback on. And I didn't want to lose them in the bulk of the document and forget that I had put it
in. Yeah, and for example, I'm reading that, just as Mrs. Eager pointed out, you know, that change was made. What is the logic behind that change? Well, you know, I think from my perspective, it's always helpful to understand,
sure,
you know, what is it that we're trying to accomplish with that change, or what is that objective?
The health department standard did go up. Mm-hmm. It used to be a half gallon.
Is that right? Yeah.
I don't know when they made the change, but years ago it was a half gallon.
And there may be a very good reason for it. I just don't know the answer, right? Well, right. Why does the county feel that it's important that it has
one thing about that is, obviously, depending on pressure tanks and storage and stuff like that, envision it this way. You go out to wash your car, and you got a 5-gallon bucket that you want to fill up from your garden hose. It'll take 10 minutes to fill that bucket. if you've got a half gallon a minute and nobody's using any other water in your house. That ain't much.
Right. And I get that. And I mean, I understand that a water system is a comprehensive system. Again, my understanding is that during the site planning process, VDH would come in and say, your water system is, you know, sufficient to meet the needs of this particular site, you know, for this density, whatever the case may be. And maybe one of the wells is a 1 gallon per minute well, and another well is a 10 gallon per minute well. Well, is it constructive for us to deny that 1 gallon per minute well because it's part of a complete water system where it's being served by this, or is it not? You know, what is?
Well, I don't think they're really talking about that. I think they're talking about you drill a well on your lot, and you get half gallon a minute. They won't. The health department won't give you a permit to occupy the house. So you're going to have to go. You drill another well, so you have two half gallons feeding together. Or you go to other part of the property and get 2 gallons a minute, something like that. When you get a system, if you've got to have 100 gallons a minute because you got 100 units, let's say, it doesn't make much, it makes some difference, but at least in theory, you could say, well, we've got 21 gallon a minute and we got 180 gallon a minute, so that gives us 100 because they're all tied together.
Right.
They're tied together in series, if you will.
And so that's, you know, that's an example of my not being educated on what that would mean. And so I guess I raised the question, what was the thinking behind having a more stringent standard there?
Fortunately for me, I wasn't here when that was written, so I can also say that I'm not quite sure why that number was arrived at.
Mr. Stewart, any insight into that or not?
I'm in along the same lines as Jay. I'm at what a planner did 5 years ago with all the staff changes.
So that's not a change, that's a highlight.
That one's a highlight because it's a question. Yeah,
a question.
So that I should probably start using two different colors.
So yeah, and I guess from reviewing this, just on the outside, looking at that,
sure.
You don't know, am I looking at a change or am I looking at a question?
That's an excellent point. I need to make that more
different
clear.
Different highlight colors for sure. The legend would be great. And I think even in the PDF documents, you can annotate, you know, notes or whatever.
Right. That's an excellent idea. I should. As far as that one, that is something I highlighted because I'm also trying to figure out why that or how that number was arrived at. And I don't know yet. But
you should go ahead and annotate those changes and email them to the commissioners. And
sure.
Mr. Brian.
Sure.
Just for clarity.
Well,
we can ask Mr. Miller from the health department.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Stevens is pretty knowledgeable about this stuff, too.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Go ahead.
I noticed, speaking of the economic development chapter, I don't know whether you've looked at that a lot, too, but a lot of the charts there are really way out.
Absolutely.
Like
I actually have updated everything that I can for that. And was considering sending it along, but because we'll be meeting with Mr. Stephen or with Mr. Popowitz so soon, I thought it might be better to hold on to it. But that chapter is.
Look at that. See if all of those are needed.
All those charts?
Yeah.
I'd be happy to take out any that you want. I've already replaced them all.
I'm just, you know.
Sure.
Take a look at it because there is lots of charts there.
Sure, absolutely. I thought there were as well. I wasn't 100% sure on what was and wasn't desired still, so they've all been updated, but you're free to suggest any subtractions.
And I guess maybe even just in terms of looking at the document for discussion purposes, it'd also be nice if we had at the meetings kind of a summary of those annotations and changes.
Sure.
You know, because again, that sort of instead of us all kind of looking around at, because
trying to figure out what
you know,
happened,
I know you made some notes, and I kind of was rushing through it this afternoon before I came over, but I didn't make those notes, and so I was looking for this right now to see some of those other changes. But that was just a what I referred to earlier about where are we fitting in, and you know, what is our objective within particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is an important document for the citizens, for the people that want to move into there, the people that want to develop, and so the more cohesive it is, the better.
Absolutely.
For sure. And I know even for new supervisors, when you look at it, you say, okay, what does this mean? So again, I kind of raised the question when we were looking at our soil studies,
sure,
talking about, you know, the use of different systems. What does that mean when we say, you know, we have wet and sticky, severe soils, and what lends itself to it? And that's where, you know, the kinds of ordinances that would say, you know, chances are you're not going to be able to put in, and I'm not an expert in septic systems, but you're not going to be able to put in this kind of a septic system, a traditional drain field, because,
right,
you know, it puts out, it disperses water at too fast a rate. But, you know, these kinds of low, you know, drip systems are acceptable, you know, in our soil types because, you know, they need to do this, but we need a minimum disbursement if it's, you know, half a gallon per minute, I mean, half a gallon per hour, whatever the case may be. That's known to work within severe soils otherwise. You know, that would be an example.
Right.
And I don't know that, sure, that fits in the comprehensive plan, but that's part of what would come out of this discussion to say, how do we address that from a planning standpoint to make it easier for us to allow development, industrial, residential, whatever, mixed use, in the areas where we want to have that development.
Right. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to jump into the progress and timeline. It's only two slides, so it's pretty merciful after the last one. All right, this is our progress so far, reviewing and updating the first three chapters. It's in progress because obviously we're not done with it. However, what we would consider the first revision is complete. That was when it was sent to you for additional comments. The same is true now of the second three chapters. Chapter 6 would be the economic development, which I have not yet sent you. But it is essentially complete with the first revision, waiting for your feedback and for any additional information Mr. Popowitz has. Everything's been updated in that, and I was able to incorporate the new economic development brochure, which says a lot of the things that we're looking forward to. I was able to incorporate some of that into there as well, and I hope to have that one to you soon. Then that gets us to the third three chapters, which is in progress in that I've started on it. It's certainly not done being revised, but I have made decent headway in the historic preservation chapter, and I've spoken with a member of the school board, an employee of the school board, and we look forward to collaborating with them on a short but efficient schools chapter as well. And then the final three chapters are imminent once we wrap up all of what we just discussed. And then obviously the implementation guide is still upcoming. We haven't gotten to that yet, but we're getting there. So the new proposed timeline would be that we continue on our current path. The next major event would be advertising for public input sessions. In the previous timeline, we had had one public input session for this second round. You know, we had the three back in June, and we were looking to have one, partly because we missed Zion Crossroads with the first one, and partly just because it's important to involve the public and for them to feel welcome. It's been expanded to two, one in Palmyra and one in Zion. We don't know the exact times yet, but that'll be sometime in September, and we'll be advertising for that sometime around the end of August. As far as our work, in September, we'll be working on the introduction, the executive summary, and the vision. That's assuming that we can keep up the decent pace that we're at the moment, which is actually decent progress. It's also important to note that the chapters get easier as you go. The last few chapters are significantly shorter and less complex than the first ones that we've been working on. So then, very optimistically, but hopefully in October, we can present the updated draft to the Planning Commission, where you would make additional comments and requests and whatever else needs to be changed, giving us time to advertise at the beginning of November for the public hearing for the Planning Commission to recommend approval. Assuming that all goes well, this part of the timeline is pretty similar. We would advertise in December, early December, for the Board of Supervisors and present the final draft later that month. Of course, there's still plenty of time for something to put a hitch in this and drag it out, but at the moment, it seems like if we push, this is still somewhat realistic. And like I said, that's the entirety.
And I'd like to add that last week it was mentioned to me by Mr. Nichols the possibility of having a joint planning commission board supervisors meeting at some point this fall. And there's a possibility we can discuss the comp plan jointly with the two boards together. It's thrown in there at some point.
Back to the public input sessions there, you have Palmyra and Zion's Crossroads.
Correct.
Those are the only two that we're planning? I mean,
We did the three previously, and one was at Fork Union, one was at Palmyra, and one was at the lake. So then the idea was this time to get the other spot that the big spot that we missed, which would be Zion Crossroads.
Previously, meaning 5 years ago?
No, in June. Okay. When we did the
ones.
Oh, right. So we did those in June.
We had one citizen.
We did have one citizen at the lake. And that's one of the reasons that we're not necessarily eager to make five public input sessions, because you end up with one person at each one, maybe, or zero people at one. So if you have a few of them, it makes a little more sense. And then especially because this is down to getting to the wire, so this is going to be a much bigger and more formal presentation than the first one, which was really town hall question and answers as much as possible. So this one, would be more formalized and regimented, I guess. We're of course open to adding another one if it seems necessary, or if there's any complaints or anything like that.
The Palmyra session was very well attended. It filled up the Morris room.
I think I was here for that one.
Yeah.
It was the most packed I've seen the Morris room by far. Well, that was all I had. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, can I ask, what do you think? Do you think that this is the document that the board wants?
I think that the expectation of this document this year is just kind of a revision. It's not a major overhaul and change. Being my first time going through this process, I can say that from the perspective of a new board member, using that document to educate myself is an important part of the process, and that that maybe the sense is, while the document is too big and too drawn out and maybe not as defined, that this isn't the time that we're going to go in and change it dramatically, but to the degree that we sort of fine-tune some of these things, particularly focused around, to your point, growth and economic development, and what are our limitations in terms of infrastructure and the tools that we have, and I think that's important. And as we saw in the case of Palmyra, when it comes to our zoning and what the potential full use of zoning could be and what those impacts might be, that creates a that creates its own dynamic, right? So to be able to define that a little more closely as a group here, I think, is an important process.
So the board wouldn't mind if it was a shorter document? I think it's, just come to the county and say, may I look at the comp plan? It's like, oh, my goodness. It's overwhelming.
I think Mr. Nichols referenced the fact that the next go around we would make it shorter, but so I don't know that the planning staff is ready to take the hatchet to it at this point.
Oh, I'm ready. I've already reduced it by at least the entire document is at least 30 pages shorter.
I think
our
goal is to not necessarily content as much as make it more readable to the average citizen, where someone can average Joe can pick it up and understand what we're talking about and some of these concepts.
And
we had a compliment about our plan by planning organizations.
I thought it was very good. I'm not taking criticism to. I mean, I did think it was good. I think it was almost overwhelming in terms of what it is. But maybe because it sounds great on paper, and in terms of the actual ability of the county for whatever the reasons to execute on components of that, maybe there's a mismatch from that perspective. Maybe it's too ambitious in its overreaching goals. I mean, I think it's headed in the right direction. I mean, personally, I like low impact density. I like planned developments. I think those are all good things because I do think that it minimizes costs for the county, and I think that's a good thing. So, and I like the fact that we're focused on the CPAs and so on. I mean, overall, it seems like it's a well thought out document for sure.
Mr. O'Brien raises a pretty good point with what he's saying about the readability of it, but also more importantly about the looking at the implementation of what was called for in 09. A big part of what this review is, and we haven't necessarily gotten all the way to it yet because a lot of it is in the implementation, is looking at what was called for versus what the county has done over the last 5 years and using that to redirect. So basically we get through these first revisions and then move on to looking at the implementation, and we see what we've missed out on, what we've not accomplished. And then we can use that whole understanding to maybe go back through the document, not at the same slow and exacting pace, but now we have an idea, wow, we called for this and it just never happened. What can we do to make that part better? So what Mr. O'Brien said is absolutely correct. That's really what the comp plan review is we're not making a new comp plan. We're making the old one better, but also making it fit the present. So it's not a rewrite. We're looking at all of those things, and it's almost like we're assessing it and improving it.
Jason, if we have this joint meeting, I don't know what the goal of the Board of Supervisors is. I can't speak for everybody else here, but I know for me, the one reason I'd definitely want to be there was so we can get some direction or at least some guidance mm-hmm. from them on, are we in the right direction? Is this what you're looking for? Here's our thoughts. So as far as the planning commission's work, I can't think of anything else we need to talk to them about. I'm sure they have some other stuff, but that's fine. But that needs to be on the agenda from my perspective anyway.
Well, one thing I think, too, is we've talked about moving the community planning area in Zions Crossroads to Westland. And I think we need to be on the same page about that as we go forward because it does have a lot to do with the comprehensive plan. And it'll have a lot to do with the economic development. It'll have a closer access to highways and things like that by moving it west. May not be speaking completely for everybody, but I think the consensus of the caucus, we are somewhat in favor of moving somewhat to the west.
I think conversation. Kind of expanding it to the west is and maybe tightening it up a little bit on the.
I might be incorrect, but I thought I had included the newer map indicating that in one of the chapters that I sent. That might be in one that I have yet to send, but I thought that was in either land use or community design, the altered map.
How much conversation has the board had on moving that CPA?
I think that's really been,
We had that conversation partially at our last meeting.
Right, I mean, I think that was part of what, Mr. Nichols really in looking at kind of where some of the roads were, felt that it could be expanded a little bit more on this side, and then of course it was also, looking at the CPA zones and trimming the areas or defining them a little more tightly, I think was also part of the conversation around Palmyra as well, too. So, I think obviously the growth area happened somewhat organically in terms of where, the land is available and where the infrastructure is available. It will, in my opinion, naturally, at least in the Zions Crossroads area, happen right there in those intersections between 15 and 250. Question is, how far down does it go on 15? And then, one of my things that I've talked about on the board and just in meetings in general is that when we look at the county and we look at the importance of the Zions Crossroads area and bringing people into the county, to me, it's still a very important thing to make sure that we make that we have reasons for people to stop in Palmyra, right? In other words, we want to draw people into the county, whether that's through agricultural business, wineries, breweries, whatever the case may be, whether that's part of historical tours, whether that's part of river tours from that end. But we want to draw them into the county. We want to have them spend some money and work their way into the rest of Central Virginia, into the Blue Ridge, as they continue to explore, you know, Central Virginia in general. But stopping on the Zions Crossroads exit as opposed to driving up another two exits and hopping on 53 and bypassing us. And of course, we won't have the type of growth that will develop any real economic hot points off of 64 for many, many years, because you're not going to get it over on Boyd's Tavern, because we're at least a mile and a half, 2 miles in for a while there, and you're not going to get it down in Ferncliff because you're, again, 2 miles in, 3 miles in. So drawing people in, this is Zions Crossroads into 15 and up to 50. Those are our key areas. That's we have to make that a really attractive opportunity to bring individuals into the county, in my opinion. I think the comprehensive plan should try to reflect some of those ideas. I haven't written that, but those are some of my thoughts on that. So,
well, I think that's one of the probable reasons we need to have a joint meeting of some kind, and basically a work session to hash out, so that the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors are both on the same page. Because, we may have completely what we're thinking, maybe
they may be, and again, I'm citing the Palmyra example, and I cite that again as kind of somebody new coming in, looking at the whole process, and watching a community that is, feeling threatened by change and growth and wants to preserve what it's had, against potentially competing against some of the goals of the county. Right? If we're saying, hey, we want to attract people into this community. Well, you might want to attract a certain amount of residential density. You might want to have a certain amount of commercial density. If we continue to say, well, we're going to focus on Zions Crossroads and we're going to focus on Rivanna as our true growth areas, well, those are going to encroach on Palmyra at some point in time. So you're going to see this pressure on Palmyra, and I think from a planning perspective, while we want to preserve what is attractive about Palmyra, we also want to build on it. We don't want it just to be the same thing it is today. If you really want to attract people in, you have to have a place where they can sit down and have a cup of coffee and eat. You have to have a place that draws people into the county. This is the county center seat, and we should make it something more than just this tiny little village.
You can't even get a cup of coffee.
And you can't get a cup of coffee. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. We have however many hundred of employees, not hundreds, but 80 to 100 employees in the area of some sort or another, and they can't get a cup of coffee or get a sandwich without going, unless they go to the grocery store. So if they can't do that, tourists can't do that, they've got no reason to stop. Why are they going to look at the old stone museum? Why are they going to, look at the courthouse, et cetera, et cetera? We've got to give them some reasons to stop, and ideally, I would foresee that we end up with some winery coming in somewhere along 15, or maybe a brewery coming in at Zions Crossroads, or something along those lines, which feeds into that very active growth that's happening into this area. I mean, Central Virginia is becoming a big destination point for wine tourism, brew tourism. If you look at Nelson County, if you talk to people in there, this is what they're doing. We have a huge explosion of microbreweries in the area, and that's a kind of a natural fit. It's agriculture, again, organic farming, all those kinds of things, where this area is becoming well-known for some of those things, and we can capitalize on that and capture that traffic coming up from Richmond to this area and bring some economic development that way. So that's we have talked about that in our planning work session, in our work session at the beginning of the year, we did talk about some of those things.
Have you seen the vineyards that have been on Warner Branch Road and 619 in the county?
I thought the only vineyard in the area was Thistlegate, right? Is that what you're talking about?
This is
a new one that they're proposing?
Oh, they're going full force on that. It's right at the the corner of 619 and Branch Road.
Okay. I don't think I've seen that one yet.
But Thistle Gate's the only winery.
Right.
I'm not sure it's the only grapes planted.
The only grapes planted. Well, and that's even again, just looking at agricultural business, I think that what you're going to see happen is a winery in the area, or two or three, are going to gain a reputation, and then you're going to see an increase in the need and the demand for grapes overall.
You'd be surprised if you really look at this. If you don't know it's there,
yeah.
Now, you go see it. Okay. Right at the Rural Lake Road and Branch Road right there.
Okay. Yeah, I bike down that way, so I'll definitely look for it. I'm surprised I've missed it.
They just planted 500 to 1,000 more.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, there's enough density now that between Thistlegate, between Blenheim, between Jefferson, folks are traveling on these roads. I think most of them are coming in, unfortunately, through 53 and as opposed to coming down 15. Although we might have some people coming in through 6. You're seeing some growth of wineries on in Richmond, on you know, in Goochland. On 6 as well, too, on what they call, what is that, the...
What's the one right across?
This right across the line. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's part of the, not Constitutional Trail, but the, I cannot think of it. Instead of the Jefferson Trail, we have it's a Confederate trail, but it's not Confederate, something like that. It's a winery name for that, those wineries on that tour. So you have people coming up 6 on that side and capturing Thistlegate from there. So 15 is an important corridor, I think. If you look at that corridor, it's going to be an important corridor for us, not just 250. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of growth coming out the Albemarle side from 250. I'm sure you read that there were one development was just approved, and I think they're trying to get another development on that as well, too. So you're definitely seeing 250 pushing down into this area as well.
And that's also a home brewery that's starting to be developed on Branch Road. I know that you had some discussions with the planning
department. Was that recently?
Yeah, I think he talked to Steve. He said Steve emailed email about it recently.
Okay, I'll need to touch base with Steve then, because I haven't heard anything out of that recently.
This is changing the conversation a little bit, but in transportation, and often through the comp plan, we talk about how we want people to walk and bike, and we don't want them to use their automobiles. But realistically, in a rural county, that's almost impossible. I mean, even they want us to, I lived in Portland. I went to the grocery store pulling my cart behind me, and it's hard. Particularly, I was a young person. It's really hard on the older people. So I don't know that it's we should need to put that much emphasis, because it repeats it over and over. How we want people walking and biking. You know, it's a wonderful thought, and it can happen. You know, at Pleasant Grove, they've got great trails there, but I don't think that it can be. You know, everywhere. I mean, lots of our conservation clusters, some of them have trails. And I know Two Rivers has got trails.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how the rest of you feel about it.
Yeah, that caught my eye as well, too. I mean, that statement there, it was, again, sort of seemed like something that was captured out of a different community and put into here. But on the other hand, I'd be living at the lake, for example, the fact that a bike trail was never... you know, made a part of it. I mean, granted, it's very safe. We don't have sidewalks.
Yeah.
It is, you know, I still think it's very safe just because it's still policed and and so on, and that, you know, the traffic isn't that high on Jefferson per se. But, you know, if it was any bigger, then yeah, it would be a problem for sure.
A lot of places are using abandoned railroads and building bike trails on them. I know some friends of mine go to Falmouth.
Right.
And ride that trail there. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting idea.
So I don't know, which, should we focus on?
Well, they're talking about the fact in that they're talking about widening the roads and putting on bike lanes and so forth like that. And the situation is right now, repair of the roads is probably the biggest thing we have now.
Well, and that's a tough one too, because again, you look at, say, an area along this part of where we are right now, you know, take a Two Rivers development, not really applicable in many cases because a cluster development is relatively small. The use of trails and the open space and all that certainly encourages people walking and being healthy. I think that's great, but would sidewalks add any value to the Two Rivers development? Probably not a whole lot, just because it's, you know, relatively small from that size. However, you go down and you look at what Zion's Crossroads might become in 25, 30 years, and not having sidewalks down there could be a real problem, right? So I think that's kind of a double-edged sword in terms of, if you don't speak about it, then maybe people think that's not important, but...
Well, I think, you know, we should mention it. I just don't think it needs to be as repetitive as it is. Yeah, and I when you're building a bigger subdivision, like Poplar Ridge, or in the 70s, had they thought to put sidewalks in, it would have been nice.
Yeah.
They might have told to have that.
Right. But, yeah, it's a lot harder to do after the fact.
Yeah.
A lot harder to do after the fact, so.
Different time, so different thoughts. Do we need to have any more discussion, or are we just going to leave it up to Mr. Lindsay to do some more further development and us to review the economic development chapter, so when we have a work session with Mr. Popovich, that we can have questions and so forth that, because the last few times we've gone through the chapters, we've gone through it basically page by page, we've gone through the goals and the steps to reach the goal. We've accomplished a lot in the work session that way, I think.
It definitely sped up our process doing that. I, understanding that it's not fully complete, I'd be happy to send you all the economic development chapter as it is, which does have all the data updated. It you know, not all of the what it calls for is necessarily accurate, but rather than looking at the old economic charts and things, it would give you that. It still needs a lot of changes, but I'll definitely try and get that to you, I guess, tomorrow, so that you have enough time to look at that before we meet with Mr. Popowitz.
You also sent us the stuff about the offers.
Yes, absolutely.
And
this, and the annotated,
these changes,
sure,
these annotations and so on. Would be, you know, just, that doesn't have to be anything fancy or formal, but hey, here's my question, what's my thinking?
Right.
I think that adds some insight into that. For
and
sure.
And I needed to hear that from somebody, because obviously when I'm looking at it, it all makes sense, because right, I'm the one that did it, so I needed to hear that. You know, not everything's being communicated perfectly.
Absolutely.
If there's no other business we need to conduct tonight, is everybody in favor of adjourning?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Y'all have any more before? Okay, we're adjourned at 8:34.
Basically, we're going to go over economic development chapter.
But we may not. This is going to be there, so we should be prepared to ask questions about where the chapter is now. And he may be getting some ideas for stuff that they need to add.
See, this is the question.